Keeping the team together. Keeping the team together. The final days of primary school carried a strange electricity. There was laughter in the corridors, yes, but beneath it, something heavier, a sense that something meaningful was slipping away. Remy and his friends, battle-tested on muddy pitches, bonded through bruises, goals, and giddy post-match highs, were about to scatter like leaves in the wind. New schools, new uniforms, new beginnings. And yet, all they could feel was the weight of goodbye. On the last day, emotions ran high. There were group photos, messages scrawled in Lever's books, and teary hugs exchanged under brave smiles. But it wasn't just school they were mourning. It was the team. Their team. The one thing that had made them feel bigger than the playground, stronger than the world. They loitered long after the bell. Nobody wanted to be the first to leave. And then Remy asked the question no one else dared voice. So, is that it for the team? The silence that followed said everything. That evening, with that question still echoing in my mind, I sat in my cafe across from Marco. The sun had dipped low over Manor House Gardens, throwing long golden streaks across the grass, our old training ground, right outside the window. I stared at it. What if we didn't let the team break up? Marco raised an eyebrow. You serious? I nodded. We form our own club, enter the Bexley League, do it properly, independent. His answer was instant. Let's do it. And that's how Lee Rangers was born, out of stubbornness, loyalty, and love for a group of kids who deserved to keep playing. We drafted a constitution, opened a bank account, and registered with the league. I took on the role of chairman and manager. Marco, ever reliable, became secretary and assistant manager. We begged, borrowed, and cobbled together whatever we could. Old kits, cones, footballs, clipboards. It wasn't glamorous, but it was ours. There was, however, one glaring absence. Caitlin. She'd been a midfield engine. Quick, tough, commanding. But the league didn't allow girls. Charlton Athletic already had girls' teams and had spotted her potential, inviting her to trials. But her mother steered her in another direction, toward St. Dunstan's, a private secondary school in Catford, where sport wasn't just encouraged, it was a discipline, almost a creed. She made the netball team almost immediately. The decision was sensible, but it stung. The team felt different without her. Still, we pushed on. We trained on the garden's pitch near the cafe. To cover basic costs, pitch fees, gear, equipment, we charged each player £3 a session. But soon cracks appeared. Some kids showed up empty-handed, embarrassed. Others, less empathetic, made snide remarks. A quiet tension crept in. Football was supposed to unite them, not divide them. One night, after a long conversation with Marco and Diane, I said what we were all thinking. This isn't right. We're not turning kids away because of £3. Okay, Marco said. But then how do we fund this? That's when the idea struck. We had a pitch. We had kids. We had community. Let's throw a tournament. We called Jimmy from Botton's Funfair, a local legend with a soft spot for community causes. He agreed to supply bouncy castles and kids' rides in exchange for a cut of the takings. We charged teams a modest entry fee, organized medals and a trophy, secured referees, and planned every detail, from face painting to food stalls, from flyers to music. And when the day came, the park came alive. Kids tore through the grass with painted faces, chasing footballs in each other. The metal cage echoed with cheers, goals, and the thrum of friendly competition. Families brought fold-up chairs and flasks of tea. Strangers became teammates. Local businesses chipped in. Lenny even turned up with his donkeys, the same ones from outside Greenwich Park. It was chaos and joy all at once. We didn't just raise enough to fund the team, we lit a fire. The council noticed. Glendale noticed. Friends of Manor House Gardens noticed. They backed us fully. And what began as a simple fundraiser soon evolved into something much, much bigger. Party in the Park, an annual tradition. A full-blown community festival with live music, dog shows, food trucks, craft stalls, and thousands of smiling faces. What started with 50 people grew into an event drawing 10,000 plus each year. Oh, and yes, my cafe's takings went through the roof. But the real triumph wasn't financial. It was this. A ragtag football team, almost disbanded, had sparked a movement. A celebration of community. A defiant stand against exclusion. A testament to what can happen when you say, we're not done yet. And when I think back to Remy's question, that quiet, heartbreaking question, it still gives me chills. So, is that it for the team? It wasn't. Not even close. In 2019, Diane and I packed up our lives and moved to Eastbourne. The sea air was a balm we hadn't known we needed, quiet, wide, and full of space to breathe again. But only a year later, the world changed. 2020 brought COVID, and with it, a slow, creeping stillness that would reach further than any of us could have imagined. Then, on January 18th, 2022, my phone buzzed with a message that cracked my heart in two. Marco was gone, taken by COVID. It was his son, Matthew, who broke the news. His voice over the phone was steady, but you could hear the weight behind every word. And then, gently, he asked if I would speak at the funeral. Of course I said yes. Not only would I speak, I offered to cater the reception myself. It was the very least I could do. Marco wasn't just a friend, he was family, a brother, a fellow father navigating chaos and joy in equal measure, a man of deep, unwavering faith, never preachy, always kind. A guitarist who played like the music was a prayer, always accompanied by Helen on the piano, his wife, his other half, his harmony. His funeral was nothing short of a celebration, a soaring, tear-streaked tribute to a man who had touched so many. The church was full, overflowing, really, with friends, family, strangers whose lives had been changed by a conversation with Marco. The service was broadcast live to his home village in Italy, where an entire community gathered around televisions and laptops to say goodbye. And when I stood to deliver my eulogy, this is what I said. To my dear rock star friend, Marco, we lost you far too soon. COVID took you from us on January 18th, 2022. But on February 18th, in a room heavy with sorrow and filled with love, we gathered to honor you. The air buzzed with stories, laughter, and tears. You would have hated the fuss, but you earned every moment of it. I still remember the first time we met. It was in the playground at our son's primary school in Lewisham. I was a ghost of myself then, grieving my first wife, Sally. I'd show up each afternoon to collect the boys, standing quietly, watching them run wild. Most parents gave me space, but not you. You walked straight over, offered your condolences, and stayed. You didn't just say the right things, you meant them. You checked in on me every single day. You asked how I was doing. You listened, without judgment, without pity. You were the kind of man who gave people room to fall apart and helped them piece themselves back together, quietly, gently, faithfully. Being a man of deep belief, you told me with such conviction that Sally was in a good place, free, happy, watching over the boys and me. And somehow I believed you. You gave me something I hadn't had in a long time, peace. Our boys, Remy and Matthew, were inseparable. Along with their football-obsessed gang, they somehow convinced us they needed to be at school by 7:30 every morning, just to get more time on the pitch. After school, they'd play until Nick, the caretaker, kicked them off. When they wanted to form a school team but had no manager, they came to me. I knew nothing about coaching, but I agreed. And when I turned to you for help, you said yes without blinking. We were clueless. We laughed about it all the time, the blind leading the blind. From that moment, our friendship deepened. Every Saturday was football. Sundays were barbecues. Weekdays blurred into scouts, swimming, sleepovers, birthdays. You were there for it all. And somehow, we even managed to squeeze in the occasional pint or game of squash, although your squash was shit. You were the kind of man who knew when I was struggling before I even opened my mouth. You had that radar, that sixth sense. You never made a show of it. You just showed up. And you were never afraid to hold the line when it mattered. I'll never forget the cup match when I had to referee. You grilled me for not calling fouls against our own players. At halftime, we were winning, but you were ready to cancel the match. Not because of the score, but because the kids needed to be protected. That's who you were. You never compromised on the right thing. I saw the same fierce love in how you raised your boys. And when I finally met Helen, I understood. The love in your home was quiet but powerful, woven into every look, every smile, every note of music played between you. And you weren't just there for my grief. You were there for my joy. When I met Diane through our school team, you saw something in us before I did. The night before our first date, I nearly backed out. I panicked. I wasn't ready. But you turned up at my house with a massive grin and a brand new shirt, insisting it was yours even though it was four sizes too big for you. While I showered, you polished my shoes. I'm still not sure whether I should thank you or curse you, but here we are, 23 years later, still together, because of you. Marco, now that you've gone ahead to wherever heaven begins, I imagine you with your guitar in hand, already singing. You're probably hunting down Sally, telling her stories, watching over Helen, Matthew, Stephen, and me. Always me. You were my brother, my compass. You were the best kind of man. You will never be forgotten. You live on in our hearts, our homes, and in every melody we hear that reminds us of your laughter. I love you, Mr. Lindsay. Always. These memories will always stay with me. Where there's a will, there's a way. Remy was always on the move, spending every possible moment playing in the park. If there was a football game, he was in it. He had a close-knit group of friends from the neighborhood. Luke, Jake, Joe Hurley, and Patty, a slightly younger boy with a creative and musical streak. They spent just as much time at our house as they did in the park, always up to something. At some point, Remy developed an interest in filming. I had bought him a camcorder along with Adobe Premiere for editing, and he took to it immediately. Looking back, I'm not sure why I encouraged it. Perhaps it was my subconscious way of keeping a connection to my past with Lipstick and IFL. Whatever the reason, he and his brothers, along with their friends, would spend hours in the gardens filming their antics, creating a makeshift version of Jackass. One of their favorite stunts involved jumping into thorn-covered bushes. At first they wore their thick parka coats for protection, but as the dares escalated, they stripped down to their waists, each one egging the other on to take the plunge. One by one, they leaped into the brambles, howling in pain before collapsing into laughter. In another clip, they buried Josh under a massive pile of leaves and waited for an unsuspecting passerby. As soon as someone walked past, Josh would leap out, sending the poor stranger into a terrified jump before the boys erupted into laughter. But perhaps the most creative of their pranks was one that Remy and Patty filmed together. The setup was simple. Remy sat on a park bench, while Patty, filming from a distance, captured the scene. An elderly woman took a seat beside him, and with no microphones to capture the audio, they later added subtitles to the footage. Remy turned to the woman and greeted her with a polite, "Hello." Then after a pause, he pointed toward the cafe and said, "My dad runs that cafe over there." The woman nodded with interest. "All my dad's customers think he's cool and kind," Remy continued, lowering his voice. "But he isn't, at least, not to me." The woman looked at him, puzzled. "Oh, he's always hitting me," Remy said solemnly. "For no reason." The old lady gasped. "I don't believe that. He's such a nice man, your dad. You must provoke him." "No, no," Remy insisted, shaking his head. "I have no clue why he does it." As he spoke, his hand slowly glided down onto the woman's knee. Without hesitation, she slapped his hand away. The clip ended with a final caption, "People are always hitting me." It was moments like these that made me laugh, watching their creativity unfold, their mischievous energy spilling over into every project. They weren't just playing, they were storytellers in their own right. The cafe in the park was more than just a business. It was my anchor. It gave me purpose, kept my sons close while I worked, and allowed me to provide for them. More than that, it built a sense of community, turning customers into friends and neighbors into family. Weekends and long summer evenings were filled with laughter and connection. I kept a rounder's bat behind the counter, encouraging families and children to join impromptu matches on the green. It was such a simple thing, but it brought people together, creating a true village green atmosphere where we all looked out for one another. One of the friendships that grew from the cafe was with a boy named William Tweedy, who was about the same age as Josh. Like Theo, Diane's son, he had a complex eating disorder. Diane had actually met William's family years earlier at Lewisham Hospital, when Theo was a patient there, before she managed to transfer him to Great Ormond Street Hospital for more specialized care. I first met William's father, Kevin, when he came into the cafe with his two younger sons, William and Josh. He'd order a latte for himself and buy a chocolate ice cream for little Josh, but nothing for William. That was when he told me about William's condition. When I mentioned Theo's similar struggles, Kevin's face brightened with recognition. "I met Theo and Diane at Lewisham," he said. "How are they doing?" From then on, William and Josh became good friends, often playing together in the park. Kevin would sometimes call me asking, Can you see William on the green? If he's there, could you let him know it's time to go home for tea? Tea, in William's case, meant that either Kevin or his wife, Lorraine, needed to feed him through the tube in his nose. The cafe had truly become a hub for the community. Families engaged with each other, children played freely, and we all shared in each other's lives. That strong sense of togetherness helped me organize a group of parents and kids to join my sons and me on a charity bike ride with bike events, from Richmond to Windsor. The year before, a smaller group, including the boys, Caitlin, and some friends, had participated in a 12 Thames Bridges charity ride. We had raised money for the Brain Tumor Foundation, inspired by Sally's battle with a brainstem tumor. The following year, we took on a tougher 32-mile ride from Richmond to Windsor, raising over £600 for the British Heart Foundation. Kevin and I became friends. He even joined me on my stag weekend in Fuengirola, Spain, near Malaga. For years, he and his boys continued to take part in our charity rides and park activities, until he and Lorraine eventually relocated to Norwich. Tragically, William's health took a turn for the worse, and he passed away at a young age. He was laid to rest in a peaceful woodland burial site in Norfolk. I went to his funeral alone. Josh had wanted to come, but Diane strongly advised against it. To honor William's memory, I wrote a eulogy, which I later shared on Facebook. Wanting to create a lasting tribute to him, we planted a tree on the green outside the cafe, the place where he had played so many times before. This was the eulogy I wrote,